Session number 13152, rule 2.
Wing Commander Parra, 3 or 2?
Well, Tim had was a Whitley pilot, captain, and he had been sent out to, on the previous night, on the night of the 9th, 10th, sorry, 10th, 11th, to a night reconnaissance for troops on the Belgian border with Germany. And I got this from his co-pilot, who was the only survivor of that raid, of that particular crew, I should say, after the war. They had agreed, Tim had navigated out to the operational area, and the second pilot was flying the Whitley at that stage. When they got to the operational area, they had discussed what they were going to do, of course. They had parachute flares, and they were going to drop some parachute flares to see what they could find on the ground in the way of troops to be bombed. And they got out there, and Tim then took over the controls, and the second pilot came back to the flare chute, which is near the door in the side of the fuselage, about midway between the nose and the tail, on the port side. And they'd arranged that there was no intercom point near the flare chute, and so they'd arranged that Tim would flash his torch when he wanted a flare dropped. And his co-pilot said he saw a flash, and which he thought was the torch, and so he dropped the first flare. He then saw another flash, and he dropped a second one. And this went on until they had dropped five flares. And about the same time as the fifth one went, this co-pilot noticed a lot of little holes in the fuselage with little blue flames licking around them. And then he saw a great wall of flame coming down the fuselage towards him. Luckily, he had his parachute on, and he only had to put his hand on the door handle and lift it. And he remembered this because there had been a modification. The door handle had worked downwards originally, and somebody had fallen out of the aircraft because they leant on it and the handle went down, and they'd modified it to open when you lifted the handle. And he remembered this, and he went out through that. And he opened his parachute, and he looked up above him, and he could see these five flares with the Whitley in front, a mass of flame going down. He was taken prisoner of war, of course. But the way I got the story was rather unusual, because it was in about 1987 or so. I was looking for a telephone number in the local telephone directory, and I suddenly saw this fellow's name. His name was Blue, Don Blue. I saw Blue there, and I thought, well, D. Blue. I wonder if that's Tim's co-pilot. So we had no contact with him after the war. And I took a chance to, oh, no, then my eldest brother, who was also, he was a VR pilot before the war, he went out to South Africa and after the war, immigrated there. He'd come over in 1980. I said 87, must have been 1977 when I was looking for this telephone number. And I had a word with him, and he said, well, let's try it and see. And we rang this chap up, D. Blue, and it was. And so we went over to see him and took him out and gave him a few jars, and he told us the whole story of what had happened. And that would, 45 years after the, 47 years after the incident. However, because of that, I think I was relieved of some flying. There was one of those days I only did one sortie, which was probably the 12th, I should think. I'm not sure. Anyway, came the 16th. I'd then done 14 operational sorties, and I had claimed 3 Heinkels, and one or two others damaged, and a third of another, which was the one I told you, I was telling you about, Trevor J. Which that one, of course, the Heikel crashed in, and so that was a third to each of us. Came the 16th, and I was given a day off, having done 14 sorties over the last 6 days, which wasn't bad, actually. And I was in bed in my estaminet upstairs when somebody started throwing pebbles at my window. It was Peter Dixon, who was the next most junior and youngest pilot in the squad, and he was an auxiliary and had really sort of been my elder brother in the squadron when I first arrived and showed me around, and we became very good friends. And I opened the window and I said, this is 7:30 in the morning, and I said, what's going on, Peter? And I thought, you know, God, we're going to be moving, or I've got to go flying or something. He said, no, we're going home on leave. And I said, don't be daft, there's a war started, we can't go on leave now. And he said, yes, we are, and there's an Avro ensign up on the airfield waiting for us, and it's not going to wait very long either. So I put my toothbrush in my top pocket and just about, and off we went. And sure enough, there was this ensign, which had been stripped completely of everything. There were the bare walls, a couple of bulkheads, which had in happier times divided the various classes of passenger, I think. And we sat on the floor. There were about eight of us on board. So there were two, I think, from 615, and there seemed to be some people from 85 and 87 who were up near Lille. They were the other two fighter squadrons for the British Army. And off we went. We flew very low over the French ground, which was pretty wise, because they'd already lost, I think, they lost altogether five of those eight ensigns in France, doing Cassivacs and resupply and that sort of thing. And eventually arrived at Hendon, where, of course, they knew nothing about us, and we were all crowded into the station adjutant's office, who rang up the Air Ministry and eventually said, you're going on 10 days' leave, and gave us leave passes. I went off to stay with some relations. I didn't have a home of my own at the time. And that was on the Friday morning, and on the Sunday morning I got a telegram telling me to report to 145 Squadron at Tanga. I thought I should be taking a replacement aircraft out to rejoin 607. Some hopes. Anyway, I went down to 145 Squadron, where they were glad to have me, I think, because there weren't many of them. There were only about 16 pilots in the squadron. The squadrons were quite small in those days because there was a shortage of pilots, of course. On the 22nd of May, I think it was, I did my first operation with them, which was a sweep round Lille and Arras. And I wondered if I could land and pick up my kit, which I'd left behind. Some hopes again. In fact, we had a set two with some 110s, where I think I damaged a couple.
Can you describe what happened in that clash with the 110s?
Oh, we caught up with them somehow, or they intercepted us. We just came together. We were slightly below their height, but it wasn't all that important, and we just climbed into them. And, of course, even at that stage, that early stage, they went into their usual defensive circle, which you must have heard about 100 times. I went straight through one of the circles firing at the aircraft as they came round. So that's why I say I think I hit a couple of them, but they didn't go down immediately and they didn't show any signs of damage. Nigel Weir was one of our pilots, and he did a contra-rotation. He went round the opposite way, firing, doing head-on attacks at them. And I think I'm pretty sure he got one that way, which was quite a good idea, I suppose, at the time. Something new. And then the patrols, we were penetrating less and less into France, and they finished up really as almost just coastal patrols. We were over Dunkirk on the 25th, although they were reading, I was reading Churchill's memoirs the other day. And again, memory is can let you down, because I thought the evacuation started on the 25th, but it didn't. It was the troops getting back into their into Dunkirk by the, were starting to come in, I think. But again, it gets very muddled, and contradictory stories arise.
Do you remember anything about that patrol on the 25th?
Not particularly, no. No, we stood there. I'm sure there were some boats and things, or destroyers, something like, you know, navy ships around the port. I'm not sure that they were actually in the port, because we were flying quite high, about 10 or 12,000 feet at that time. But the following day, there was, we did have a fight over Dunkirk. In fact, the next day, we were doing another patrol. It was a Dunkirk patrol. Roy Dutton was leading the squadron. He was the A flight commander, senior flight commander. And he saw a singleton somewhere out to sea and went after it. I was flying as number two in the rear section again, and I looked round and I saw another aircraft up to our right, which I was getting pretty familiar with Heinkel 111s by this time, and I knew it was another Heinkel, and so I called him up and said, there's another aircraft on the starboard side. And he didn't do anything. He kept on going off after this with the rest of the squadron. So I then pulled out and waggled my wings, hoping at least my section leader would follow me after this other one. He didn't. And I went off after it. And I was firing at it. I'd got his starboard wheel down and his starboard engine was smoking. And his wretched rear gunner hit my, I think it must have been the radiator, because I had a cockpit full of steam, or water vapour, in fact. It was a thick fog. I couldn't see, I could only see one instrument, which was the oil temperature gauge up on the top right-hand side of the instrument panel. And so I thought, well, that's not very good news. We were over the land by this time, north of Dunkirk. And so I did a, I broke off, obviously, a quick 180, and wondered how long the coolant would last before the engine seized. Got so hot and seized. And I got about halfway over the channel towards England Home and Beauty when the rest of the squadron caught up with me. And there was a lot of chatter on the radio. They could hear the radios then about, who is it? What's the matter with him? And I was streaming, I could see in the mirror, just above the windscreen, I could see in the mirror, I was streaming a long plume of white vapour behind me. I think it was probably quite an exciting sight, I suppose. Anyway, I eventually got a word into Roy Dutton and said, I told him who it was, and would he get me to the nearest bit of friendly land and try to maintain height as much as possible, because I didn't know when the engine was going to seize up. And he did a very good job, and we crossed the coast at Deal, and I should think almost within inches, as we crossed, as I was over the coast, the engine stopped. The fog had only disappeared a few minutes previously, and so I knew the end was, you know, pretty close. And I think I'm not sure what height I was. I can't remember what height I was now. I was trying to maintain height. I think I was down somewhere around 3,000 or 4,000 feet. And looking for somewhere to put the thing down with the wheels up. Manston was too far to the north. I couldn't make that anyway. And Hawkins was too far away down on the south side. And behind Deal there are some downs. And it was Sunday evening. And a lot of people out for their Sunday evening walk. And I picked out these three fields. One was on the upward slope of the Downs. The one was sort of slightly curved, but the dome, so to speak. And then there was another one which was going downhill fairly sharply. And I went sailing over the uphill one, and I was going fairly well across the second one too. I was just holding off, and I was only a few feet off the ground, and I didn't want to go into that downhill one. It didn't look too good. Rather dangerous. Might go over head over heels, you know. And so I just shoved the stick forward and bounced the thing into the ground. We didn't bounce, actually. It just went down and stuck. Unfortunately, I hit two sheep, which didn't get off the ground again. Spectators arrived, but didn't approach me. The next person to arrive was the local bobby on his bicycle. It was just a cart track, so they were coming up. And he came across, and I said, well, would you keep people away from this thing, because it's the guns are still loaded, while I go and find a telephone. And he pointed me to the farmhouse, which was about a quarter of a mile away, I think, from or so, or a bit more, and said, well, that's the nearest telephone, that's the farmer, they're his sheep. and as we were talking, the farmer himself arrived in a horse and trap. And he got out of his trap, and the first thing he said to me was, who's going to pay for them sheep then? And in a lordly tone, I think I said, the Air Ministry. Or try the Air Ministry or something like that. And he sort of grunted and got back in his cart, and off he went again. So I was then faced with walking down to the farmhouse to face this angry man again to ask if I used his telephone. By the time I got down there, he and his wife were having a high tea. There was a large ham on the table, boiled ham, looked super. But I wasn't invited. I went into a passage, and the dining room was on the left and the sitting room on the right. And his wife said, well, you can sit in there. After I'd done my telephone call to Manston to come and pick me up, and the aircraft, and a guard for the aircraft, of course, as well. And eventually his wife did say, would I like a cup of tea? And I thought, no, I can't be bothered. I'd rather have a whiskey or something, or a beer. Anyway, that was the end of that story. I was picked up by Manston. Oh, I arrived at Manston and was greeted by an old friend who'd been a pupil with me, student pilot with me at advanced training at Shawbury, the Honourable Michael Adderley. And he had a little unit which was doing experiments with drone aircraft and drone Tiger Moths. So he flew me back to Tangier the next day. My uniform, I might say, was absolutely soaked in glycol, the whole lot. And I don't know if you know anything about glycol, but it is sticky, it is filthy stuff. And it was the only uniform I had, because I left my second one in France. It was about the only shirt I had too, I think. Anyway, chaps rallied round and lent me some clothes while my uniform and stuff was being cleaned up by my Batman, or Batwoman. Batwoman, I think. The following day, again, we were on patrol over Dunkirk. And I don't remember much more about Dunkirk. Well, yes, by that time, the oil tanks were on fire, the smoke and filth and stuff. There was an east wind at some stage, because some of that smoke actually arrived at as far as Tangier, or if it passed Tangier. The brown, you could see the brown tinge in the air, of the oil smoke. And that was about the... Well, then we saw the last of the evacuation. In fact, we did a sweep in the morning of the... after the last ship had left, which was, what, the 3rd or the 4th? 3rd, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. 3rd of June.
Could you see anything of the troops on the beach?
Again, we were flying high, and this was their... cause for complaint, of course, that they never saw the RAF because we were too high. But there was no sense in going in low down to be bounced by 109s from above. You couldn't see an awful lot. You could see there was at least one ship lying on its side in the water. Looked like a destroyer. There were, I suppose, there wasn't much colour contrast between the troops' khaki and the sand, of course. Sand was a bit lighter, so your dark patches probably were bodies of troops, but you couldn't be sure. And there we lost Peter Dixon, who'd come home with me from France, also came down to 145 with me. But he was shot down, and we heard that he was badly wounded. And I heard two stories. One was that he was put on a stretcher on a destroyer, which was sunk, and the other one was that the Germans took him into their hospital, but he died of his wounds. So you can believe which one you like, I'm not sure. So, pause for thought.
Can I just go back to the 607 Squadron period in France? Because you were telling me earlier off the record about this number claimed of kills.
Yes.
Of more than 70, I think.
Yes, 72, I think. Yes.
Do you think that's accurate?
I think... Well, one has to accept that there was exaggeration during the Battle of Britain, and so there's the risk that there was exaggeration then. If so, I don't think it was probably very much. Because the auxiliary pilots, if you look up their ages, you'll find that they were 24, 25, Joe Carl was, I think, rising 30. They were older and maturer than most of the young pilots who came along later. Well, myself, for example. And I don't think they were the sort of person who would say they'd shot something down if they hadn't. There was one incident I'd forgotten. Nobody ever spoke about it. There were six of us. It was A flight. I was in A flight there. Being led, I suppose, by Francis Blackadder. And we came across five Dorniers, Dornier 17s, in close formation in a Vic. And we went... They just appeared out of nowhere, sort of thing, and we weren't expecting anything like that, and there they were. There was very closely... packed, and so Francis put us into line astern to attack. That was, again, one at a time going into the attack. And I, as usual, was the tail end, Charlie. And I went in at an angle of about 30 degrees off the proper astern attack, because that was where I happened to have started from. Over to the port side of these aircraft. And so I was in a position to spray the whole lot as I came down across them. And I saw some of my bullets striking the aircraft. But it didn't phase them. Their rear gunners either weren't firing or they didn't have tracer, it's difficult to say. Because there was only one... gunner firing tracer, and this was the extreme starboard one, which was the one closest to me, and he didn't hit me. And I didn't see anything of the other gunners, but they were in a perfect position as five of them to give quite a mass of fire, five machine guns all firing at the same aeroplane. But they didn't hit us. One of the aircraft, I think it was the extreme port side one, or it might have been the one just inside him, did dip and seemed to lose formation momentarily, but then recovered and came back into formation. And Francis only let us do one pass each, and for all the world, you'd think we hadn't touched them at all. They just kept going. And it was the most extraordinary episode, because we should have shot down all five with ease, and we didn't shoot down one of them. And I don't know why, whether they had a hell of a lot of armour plating or what it was. Mind you, in those days, we did not have the De Wild ammunition. And the first guy with wild ammunition, De Wild ammunition, I saw was one of the chaps who came out from England to reinforce us. And he hadn't fired it in anger or used it before. He went off and he came back and he had shot down an aeroplane. I've forgotten what it was now. But he was almost in shock himself because of the way that he reckoned this De Wild ammunition had demolished the aeroplane, which had disappeared in small pieces almost as soon as he started firing. And it had really quite astonished him.
What was this De Wild ammunition?
Explosive ammunition. Which had been banned by the Geneva Convention, I think.
When did that come in?
Well, the Geneva Convention.
No, the De Wild ammunition.
De Wild. Well, he had some of the first, and that would have been in May 1940. I'd never heard of it. I don't think most of us had ever heard of it. It was the first time I heard the words De Wild, you know. But quite astonishing.
You said that you had these three kills, apart from the...
The one shared.
The one shared, yeah. Probables.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that there were the two Heinkels on the first day that you've got no memory of.
Yeah.
What was the third one?
God, my memory is going. Where the devil was it?
But it was with 607.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Was it a Heinkel?
Yes, they were all three Heinkels. There were so many Heinkels around. Four sorties I did after the first one, I have no recollection of. They're in my logbook, and I have no recollection of them. So it was probably one of those. Because the Heinkels were coming out like there was no tomorrow. They had no escorts. They were sitting ducks, if we could only hit them. But I think we were at a disadvantage in not having more powerful ammunition. You know, we had a little bit of tracer, and they didn't like us using the tracer because it wore out the gun barrel so quickly. There was a bit of I get lost for words now. There was the ordinary armour piercing and the ordinary, most of it was ordinary ball ammunition. And then there were a few incendiaries, but again, they didn't like us using the incendiaries because they had the same effect as the tracer. The Germans, of course, had explosive cannons right from the word go. So we were at a disadvantage in that respect.
The spirit in the squadron must have been tremendous if it had all these successes in France. I'm talking about 607.
Well, it was, yes, but at the same time we were hearing ghastly stories of the advance of the German army. And on the somewhere around the 15th or 16th of May, the rumour was coming in. I don't know where the rumour came from. It was coming in that